You're listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. At Sunrise, we desire that the glory of God would be the glory of this city. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. Let's join this week's message.
Well, I think whatever you do, wherever you do it, someone is going to criticize you for doing so. Right? I know it's been said that baseball is supposed to be America's pastime, right? That's what people say. I haven't heard that in many years because I think we have a new one. I think in our modern world, I think judging others is America's favorite sport to play. For example, I'm sure many of you could do this with your own vocations and what you do for a living, but here, from my perspective, is a bunch of criticisms that I've received. Some I've deserved, not all. Some have come from left field, some from outside in the parking lot, things like this, not sure why they came. But here are some criticisms that I've received and my friends as pastors have received. Some say, if a pastor's too young, he lacks experience. But if he's too old, he won't be relevant. If he has six or more kids, some will say he's irresponsible. But if he has no kids, they'll say he's setting a bad example. If he uses a ton of illustrations in his teaching, he's probably neglecting the Bible. But if he doesn't use any illustrations in his teaching, he's probably not going to be practical. If the pastor doesn't call out sin where sin is, many will say he's soft. But when a pastor does call out sin where it is, many others will say he's too hard. If a pastor drives a car that's too old and falling apart, some will say he's shaming the congregation. But if he drives a car that's too new or too electric, others will say he has clearly given himself to the world's affections. Many of you could do that with your own vocations, your own callings in life, displaying all the myriad of ways you have been or could be criticized. There are even YouTube channels. This is probably not news to you, but there's whole YouTube channels that their whole purpose and whole existence is to do live reaction videos where in the moment as they hear it and see it for the first time, they then critique, and the more negative, the more wildly negative the critique is, the more popular the video becomes, and the more views it gets. This is the world we live in. And while it's trendy to do this, to critically condemn others in our own age, it is not new or something fresh on the scene of history. It was very present all throughout the ages because sadly, part of what it means to be a fallen man and a fallen woman is to be condemningly critical of others. I mean, it doesn't take a lot. Like, you could be on the golf course and you could have a 3-foot putt. It's this far away, and you and your buddy can be sitting there, and I never putt well when I golf, like the 2 times a year I do with Tim. I just never putt well, and I always leave it short. And of course, someone's like, does your mom golf too? And I'm like, stop! Jesus has much to teach us about this very thing. There's a consistent theme of destructive tendencies last week and this week in the Sermon on the Mount, really lots in the Sermon on the Mount, but these 2 weeks in particular. Last week, we finished Matthew chapter 6. We looked at the destructive tendency about having possessions, not so much about having them, but having them in such a way where they possess us, and we grow all kinds of anxious, sinfully anxious about them. That's a very destructive tendency. Well, in a similar way, this week, as we come into Matthew 7, as this chapter begins, another destructive tendency is in view, about our hasty, critical, condemning judgments about one another. Did you notice that last part? About one another? That really matters for the message today, especially in the text today. Because I think, as much as we'd want to say, all this condemnation and worldly critique and criticism, we all think, that's out there, it's out in the world, it's not in here. But really, this kind of hasty critical condemnation is alive and well in the church. Some people in the church even think it's their calling by God to so criticize and condemn their brothers and sisters. Of course, it's never called this. It's always under the label of encouragement, or I have a word for you, brother. I'm like, oh, here we go. Batter up. Give me right here, you know? I'll turn the other one after. That's what I feel like happens. But here's a question as we begin. Does this critical, judgmental spirit, does it reside in you? I think if we're all honest, the answer is yes. If we're willing to face that, the answer is yes. So Matthew 7, 1 to 6 is before us. And because we answered yes, we need to know that here the Lord has a better way for us, something higher for us to learn. This text easily divides into four sections. We'll go through them one at a time. So see first, just verse 1 and 2, the critical spirit exposed. Verse 1 and 2. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. I think other than John 3:16, this verse right here, Matthew 7:1, might be the most famous verse in all the world. Right? Because how many times have you heard it, or maybe you yourself have said it, when you felt judged by a Christian, a church, or a various ministry of some kind? But is that what Jesus means? Right? That of all people, it's Christians who must never judge regardless of the situation, regardless what's going on. It's Christians that just have to be accepting and inviting and inclusive of everyone. Is this what Jesus has in mind here? And judge not, lest you be judged, you judgmental Christians. There are many within the wider church that would say this is exactly what Jesus is teaching. This is what he would have you embrace. This is the posture you need to accept and adopt into your life. And it's always been like this in every age of church history. There's always been someone who has been teaching this passive, non-judgmental Christianity. What I've often found about such people, well, let's judge them. It's appropriate for the text. You'll see why in just a second. What I've often found about such people is they always want our faith to be about love. It's never defined, though. You just have to love other people. And so they would never do things that we have already done today. We all together recited a very precise and nuanced statement of a historical doctrine, a doctrine that's so important that every man and woman will stand or fall before God based on what they believe about justification. It's this important. But they don't want to do things like this because it could cause division, it could cause debate, and it could break peace. Peace at any cost, anything for a quiet life.
they say. More so, I think this is what the world just kind of expects us to be as Christians. Perhaps you've been in a discussion with people even around like political matters or moral matters, and they say, well, what do you think about that? Then you state what you think, and they go, well, how can you be so judgy? Didn't Jesus say to not judge, you judgmental Christian? And you're like, it's like heads you win, tails I lose. That's what this feels like when the world quotes this verse. Does Jesus mean any of this? Any of these things? Of course not. This is not what Jesus has in mind. We'll see this firsthand as we walk through this passage and later on as we get to verse 6, where we will actually learn that Christians are to be people who judge rightly, judging others rightly and judging situations rightly. So for us, living in the time that we live, we must get this text right. We must get it right because it's so unpopular in our day. So what is actually in view? Let's look at it. There in verse 1, judge not. The key word here, verse 1, is the word judge. The English word judge is pretty straightforward, pretty general and common, has a broad range of meaning from everything from the man or woman with the gavel or even a general assessment about anything under the sun is called a judgment. Right? It's like everything in between we use this word for. That's the English word. The Greek word has a narrower meaning. Matthew, as he's originally writing this gospel, writes in Greek, and as he's getting to verse 1 here in chapter 7, he said, me krino, judge not. That's what the word is, krino. It's a very specific word that is really only often used in the first century in a courtroom or legal setting as the one presiding, as the judge is passing sentence. Giving the final verdict, the word krino then comes into the conversation. It was not there before. Now it is, as this man or this woman's fate is decided. That's krino. So knowing that, we could retranslate verse 1. Condemn not that you be not condemned. That's a legitimate translation of verse 1. So this critical, condemning spirit, then, is the very thing we're to avoid. Yet, we know this spirit far too well, don't we? It comes from an angle of self-righteousness, from a feeling of superiority, that we ourselves are right, that others are not. It's where the phrase probably comes from, trigger happy. This person is always ready to pull the trigger and to condemn someone else and to let everybody else know that this person's intentions are the worst of all possible intentions. And then a gladness comes, a glad yet wicked satisfaction that this person has received what they deserve. Critique. This does describe the Pharisees, the Jewish leaders of this first century, Jesus' time, but it also describes anybody who has that kind of spirit of a Pharisee. If you don't do faith their way, your faith is automatically wrong. This is the critical, fault-finding, condemning spirit of verse 1. And it shows itself for Christians in a whole load of different ways. Specifically, two ways. I think Christians, especially Christians, if you have social media, which is like 99.9% of you, there's always the rare bird that doesn't do this. And it's like, whoa. Really? Like, what do you do with your free time? Do you read? Do you read Encyclopedia Britannica?
Christians on social media, right, when someone's famous out there in the world, or Christian famous, whether it's like a conference speaker, popular pastor, author, someone just as well known in certain circles of the church, whenever they do something, or do something right, do something wrong, or make a statement about something, there's always Christians that are so ready at the keyboard or on their phones to give their critical commentary of so-and-so and really what they're doing. Have you seen this on social media? You see something like this happen, you're like, oh, that's going to be explosive. But then you know, oh, your like hand just goes there. I got to see the comment section. And you're just scrolling and scrolling. Yeah, I should not have clicked on this. I should not have clicked on this. Looking for encouraging things in a comment section online is like trying to find a clean gummy worm in a toilet. It's just not something that's going to happen to you. It's not going to happen. That's one way that Christians do this kind of judgy, critical condemnation. But it hits closer to home when we realize that this is not just something that happens like out at a distance to us. We do this with our friends and our family. Like the ones we know the most, we do this with. Like perhaps something is done, something is said, something's undone, something should have been said. But you, when you didn't have to, you picked up a fence, and all of a sudden you are ready to critique and just slam them home, drive it into them. This happens in the church, in the same church, sadly, all the time. And it is wicked. So the command against this is in verse 1. We need to see that. But the reason for the command is in verse 2. Do you see that? To be so condemningly critical of others is to invite not only others to judge you in similar ways, it's to invite God to judge you in similar ways. I mean, Matthew 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, right, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, Jesus starts to kind of wind down. And there's been a lot of punches that were not pulled by Jesus throughout this sermon, the most famous sermon in all of history. But here, as he winds down in chapter 7, there's going to be punch after punch after punch. This is the first one that we need to feel, face, and be sobered by, as he says that our judgment of others invites the judgment of God on us. It's sobering and searching. One early church father 1,800 years ago named John Chrysostom read this, and he said, when we judge others, we make, quote, the judgment seat dreadful for ourselves. Think on this, church. This is a very neglected doctrine in the modern church, the judgment of believers at the end of all things. This judgment in verse 2 is not judgment that Jesus talks about between the wheat and the tares, the sheep and the goats, heaven or hell. This is not that judgment. This is the judgment Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, when he says, "For we all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." So there is true gain, eternal gain for the Christian. It's not a heaven or hell thing, but there's eternal gain for the Christian who does not give room to this critical, condemning spirit of verse 1. Just as there is eternal loss, not heaven or hell, but there is eternal loss for the Christian who does give room
and grows in this critical, condemning spirit of verse 1. It's a wildly neglected doctrine, but one that's present here in Matthew 7, 2, and present in 2 Corinthians 5, 10, and you're not going to hear much else about it. It's a bit mysterious there. But we need to see what's at stake when we judge others. So do we want to set ourselves up like this? Do we really, knowing what's at stake, the measure we use will be used against us, how critical we are of others, that's how critical God will be of us? Yikes! I mean, do we really want to set ourselves up as judge and authority and jury and executioner of our brothers and sisters like this, knowing this? I mean, how many of you would ever feel no reservations, you'd be totally fine and glad to pray this in front of everybody, God, judge me like I judge others? None of you would do that. Yet, we want mercy for ourselves. You see the irony here. How crooked we are, so quick to judge, and we need to hear it from verse 1 and 2. It exposes us. Few things are as ungodly and unchristlike as a critical, condemning spirit toward another Christian. That's how Jesus begins his explanation of this. To help us, our next heading, verse 3 and 4, he will illustrate this for us. So see the critical spirit illustrated, verse 3 and 4. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is the log in your own eye? Here, verse 1 and 2 is driven home powerfully with this ridiculous word picture, right? I mean, it almost explains itself, doesn't it? Let's talk about it. One person goes to another because of a matter of sin. Right? Someone's going to another to talk about their sin. Happens all the time. Something that should be normal in the Christian life. But the one being called out for sin, while they truly have sin, notice how small the sin is. It's called a speck. It's very small, meaning it's very easily dealt with and removed. You could just, and the speck of dust is gone. That's all that's needed. Ironically, the one bringing all this up has his own sin that is far greater. It's called not a speck, but a log. I mean, you get the humor of the illustration? Like, picture a log, and then picture it sticking out of your eye. In both eyes, right? You get two logs there. This is just not happening, right? You can't see anything if that happens to you. That it's called a log, contrary to the speck, easily dealt with, easily removed. Log, massive issue, hard to deal with, very difficult to remove. The detail that makes this illustration humorous is that the guy who begins the conversation with the log doesn't know the log is there. Yet the guy with the speck, you seem to be like, what? I have a speck? You log man? What? Are you serious? Have you looked in the mirror? He's like, yeah, I'm fine. It's like, you're not fine. We would all laugh more if this weren't so tragically common in the church. The point is this of the illustration. It's not that in every situation the one passing judgment on another has the greater sin. That's not the point. That's not always the case. No, the point is that what this ignorant person finds wrong with his friend
is a very small matter when compared to his own personal issues. The irony is sad and it's destructive. We far too easily call out sins in others to our heart's content while we got all kinds of sin that we're like, I'm not touching it, I'm not dealing with it, it's just there.
Part of the problem makes it worse is that we tend to believe the best about ourselves and the worst about others. So flip it around, the log man probably thinks his own sin is a speck, while he thinks the speck is a log in his brother or sister. It's a huge problem. So the point has been taught, verse 1 and 2, illustrated, verse 3 and 4. Look at verse 5. The critical spirit is corrected. You hypocrite! First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. I mean, is not the go-to illustration for this that moment in David's life after he had the affair with Bathsheba, got in some hot water there, she got pregnant, oh my gosh, what's going on? I have to kill her husband, so he does so. Everything's normal, right? Here comes Nathan, the prophet, with a tall tale, a divinely inspired tall tale, about, hey, King David, there's this guy. He's in the kingdom. He's got a lot of sheep. Got tons of sheep. He stole his neighbor's sheep. His neighbor only had like two. Now he just has one. He had a whole bunch of them. His friends came over. He doesn't use one of his own. He uses this guy who's got nothing. Now he's got less than what he had before. Only one sheep left. What do we do? And David's like, that man should be killed. And then Nathan, that famous line, you are that man. And David is cut to the core about his own adulterous activity, murderous streak in him. This is clear, church. Log-carrying speck inspectors are hypocrites. Log-carrying speck inspectors are hypocrites. If we truly want to help others care for souls sick with sin, there's something you've got to do first. What do you have to do first? Deal with your own sin. You've got to deal with your own sin. The log toter must remove the log if he's to see clearly the speck in his brother or sister's eye. Then, Jesus says, you will see clearly and you'll be able to take out the speck from your brother's eye. If we refuse to do this, and the log is, we're content to have the log there and just ignore it and just go around talking about everyone else's sin, we will be hypocrites, majoring in the sins of others, minoring in our own, walking around in life with a sad combination of ignorance and arrogance. Do you really want to be that guy or that girl? Do you want to be this person? Well, here's a tip. No one likes this person. Don't be this guy. Don't be this girl. Don't be ignorant of your own sins. Don't be arrogant thinking yourself, oh, I don't struggle with these things. Let me go talk about all these other speck people. Well, they can clearly see, oh, here comes the log man. The principle being taught here is so helpful in verse 5. We've seen the problem. The remedy is here in verse 5. The remedy to the critical condemning spirit is to get a true sight of ourselves. That's the remedy. Maybe I could even use these glasses to talk about it. I went to the doctor a lot growing up. Well, not a lot. Like, you know, you go every year for physicals, you're supposed to. I went at like 33 again, like the first time in 20 years. And they were like, why are you here? And I was like, do people get physicals still? And they were like, and I was like, okay, sorry, I'll just go home. Jeez. But there's one doctor I never really went to, is the eye doctor. You know, I just figured I can see, so my eyes are fine. Like, I have friends that have glasses. I've tried them on. It's like, whoa, they're like, you know, Coke bottle-like things. I'm like, I don't need those. But all of a sudden, I noticed, I was there in the office. It was like 3 years ago. It was not too far away. My eyes started to feel like fatigued and tired. It's like, what's going on? Like, I just feel like my eyes like ran a mile. Like, what is this? Maybe it's my screen. Maybe I need those trendy like blue light blockers, whatever that voodoo is, right? So I get those. Nothing changes. I'm like, oh man, maybe I'm just watching my screen too much. So I put my phone away for like a week, try not to look at it too much, have to look at my computer, turn the brightness down, do it on the TV, still there, go to the eye doctor, and I'm just like, what's going on? And you know, the test. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna fail this thing. I can't see those letters. It's like, seven, oh, I mean, Q! You know, I'm going to have the Coke bottles here in a minute, and people are going to look at me at church and judge me and be all critical of what I'm wearing at church with my Coke bottle glasses. Anyway, it went fine. But the doctor told me, he said, hey, do you know you have astigmatism? And I went, what's that? I was like, I've heard a lot of isms in my day. I've never heard that one. What is that? He said, oh, you know how doctors just throw this stuff out. What's wrong with you? Your eyes are shaped like footballs. They're not circles. I'm like, oh, okay. He said, you need glasses for astigmatism. And I was like, okay. Is that why they're tired? Like, that's why I came in here. He's like, yes. I'm like, answers. Okay, cool. Nice. So he gives me the prescription. I go, you know, to the cheap glasses site, not get them in the store because they're hundreds of dollars. So get like a $7 pair of glasses from online, put them on. Guys, I spent like 37 years of my life looking at trees. And I thought they were pretty cool. I did this, and I could like count the leaves. I was like, this is what all of you are seeing. Not fair, but I'm like, finally, I can see. Like, I can see brush strokes in the paint, you know, like with this. I'm just like, wow, this is amazing. It gave me a true sight, all that to say. That's the remedy for the critical, condemning spirit. We have to be willing to look at ourselves. What do I mean? You have to own your sin. You have to see yourself as a sinner, justly deserving the sovereign displeasure of God. You have to own what we sang. Our sin, my sins, they are many. His mercy is more. Or was that a lie to you if you didn't mean that? Why'd you sing it then? Right? It's why we sing what we do. We're teaching ourselves to see ourselves as the Bible would have us see ourselves. When we see ourselves with a true sight, when we have a clear sight of our own sin, we will not critically condemn others. What will we do? We will want mercy for others. Because God has so blessed us in the gospel that we will want to then be a blessing to everyone else and have them so do life with them that they enjoy the mercy of God in the gospel themselves. That's the remedy to the critical spirit. Seeing yourself as a sinner, not as superior to the sinners around you. Maybe another way to say it is that when you see yourself as a sinner, you no longer see all the people around you as nails and yourself as the hammer. I'm sure names just came to mind for some of you. Or maybe you yourself, you're like, oh, that's me. Every problem's a nail, I'm the hammer. If that happens in a congregation, like if we could hear that happen, it'd just be like all the time. And you look around and there's holes in everything. And like people are knocked out on the floor. There's holes in people, holes in the walls. It's so destructive. So destructive. Another way to say the same thing is this: judgment, if it's godly and true, must always begin with ourselves. We can't major in the sins of others and minor in our own. Flip that, and that's the healthier posture. That's how the critical spirit is corrected. So we've seen it taught, illustrated, corrected. That's verse 1 to 5. Now see verse 6. I've titled this last heading, "The Critical Spirit Helped." Verse 6, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." That's a strange verse, isn't it? Like, we can just be honest about that. Like, there's a huge debate. If you're reading through the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, you're like, okay, I'm tracking with you, tracking with you. You get to verse 6, you're like, what just happened? It's like off the rails all of a sudden. Does verse 6 go with verse 1 to 5? Or does it go with verse 7 to 11? Or is it its own thing? Should it be there? Like, did Matthew make a mistake here? Like, all these questions are coming to mind. You're like, of course not. This is inspired by God. It should be there. Well, then what does it mean? Well, think about it like this. I think it helps the critical spirit. It should be with verse 1 to 5. We've already said it's wrong for Christians to never judge. We've also said that it's wrong to judge in a certain way, to be critically condemning of your brothers and sisters in Christ. How then do Christians judge rightly? Verse 6 teaches us the other side of the coin. We've seen the wrong, judging wrongly. Now we see judging rightly in verse 6. Or we could say this: verse 1 to 5 taught us how we can easily judge too harshly. Verse 6 teaches us how we can easily judge too naively. Jesus uses, to teach us this, two of the most derogatory labels of his day: dogs and pigs. Some of you have pigs for pets. It happens today. I didn't grow up having pigs for pets, the standard, like dog or cat, you know, or goldfish that lives for like 2 weeks and dies, right? This is standard pets. But today we think of like any animal, like raccoons even. Like, social media is crazy, right? It's a circus. Anything's a pet online. This is not what Jesus has in mind when he brings up dogs and pigs. These were, in the first century, unclean animals. Dogs were not furry little clean creatures. They were scavengers. And pigs, their only use was bacon and pork for Gentiles, not for Jews. Still is. Jews of Jesus' day used these two terms, dog and pig, to describe Gentiles. Like, the pagans are so unclean to us, God's chosen people, right, the superior posture that the Jews had, that they're the dogs and pigs of society. So how do we then interpret in our own day who the dogs and pigs around us are? It's never a Christian. Let me just say that. Verse 6 never has a Christian in view. But generally speaking, the dogs and pigs of the world are those who reject Christ and his gospel, Christ and his kingdom, those who reject the message of the Sermon on the Mount, fall into the category that Jesus is using as wicked dogs and pigs. But there's other terms we have to define too, right? Do not cast what is holy or your pearls. So what is holy and what is a pearl? It's the message of Christ
and all that comes along with him in the message. That is what is holy. That is the pearl. So what's being taught in verse 6? We're not to be critically condemning and judgmental toward others, but we must wisely discern and judge other people and situations that we find ourselves in. Meaning, the gospel is so precious to us. I mean, in just a few chapters in Matthew, Jesus will call his message the pearl of great price. He's saying here, you can't just throw this out anywhere. Because some people that hear it will trample on it and treat it no different than the slop that pigs eat. That's what verse 6 is talking about. So verse 1 to 5 told us how to judge wrongly. Verse 6 teaches us how to judge rightly. We're not to be judgmental hypocrites, but we're also never encouraged to not discriminate with the gospel. That's so not okay in modern culture, right? This is not the modern sentiment at all. That's so inclusive of everybody. And here we're saying, you need to discern if you need to continue to share the gospel with this person because they've rejected you consistently for years. You should probably stop and go on to someone else. Is the gospel precious to you? Then don't allow this person you keep talking to treat it like pig slop. Go to someone else. There's examples upon examples in the New Testament about this. Remember, the disciples get sent out by Jesus. If the message they're preaching of the kingdom is received, they stay and they teach more about the kingdom. And a little church is built and a community is formed, similar to here. But if the message is rejected, Jesus said, shake the dust off your feet and go to the next town. This is why in the book of Acts, the apostles did this in all their missionary journeys. Paul, in particular, had such a monumental moment with this. He kept going to the Jews day after day, night after night, trying to plead with the Jews in their own synagogues that Jesus was the Christ, showing the gospel from the Old Testament night and day, but they kept rejecting him. He got to a point where he said, I'm no longer going to talk to you. I will turn to the Gentiles from here on out. Something of the same posture needs to be embraced by us. And this requires discernment and wisdom. I mean, God has given us the gospel, the message of redemption that we never graduate from. And it is so precious to us. Why? Why would we keep throwing it out to those who reject it and trample it under their feet? In this and in these matters, we must judge rightly and move on. Remember, this does not refer to any Christian. It's all those outside that are lost, that are hearing the gospel. So, church, what have we said today? Lots of words have been said. I hope some of them have been helpful to you. We're never to foster or grow in a critical, condemning spirit. Never allow it to take root and grow in us. But God does want us to be discerning and wise and judge rightly while we avoid judging our brothers and sisters inside the church wrongly. This is a weighty call. So weighty that it makes me just want to say, geez, how do I know the difference? How do I judge situations rightly? I lack the wisdom I need, so I must ask God, who gives wisdom, to help me do this. It's what all of us need to be thinking. Who's sufficient for these things? Well, church, God is sufficient for these things. He can enable us, give us wisdom, and guide us in all these things, and help us judge rightly. So in all of our need, in all of our weakness, in all of our inadequacies, the Lord is eager to show Himself strong, wise, able, and adequate. Look to Him for everything. Let's pray.
Thank you for listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. We pray you are blessed by the preaching of God's Word. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. May the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all.